Talk Shoe. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess and friend of Juranov. And welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when they're interested in listening to it, which is after you download it, you just hit play on your iPad, iPod, computer, whatever device you have, whenever you have time to listen to the show. Today we have a really interesting show, which I'm extremely thrilled to be doing with two of my favorite people in the field. Maura Grossman has done a number of ESI Bytes shows with me in the past. In fact, she's such an expert in this space, I just finished a stint about 3 weeks ago where I saw her speak live in person three times over the course of a week and a half. And amazingly, she has not yet put a restraining order in place, but I told her I'll probably leave her alone now except for doing the podcast with her, which we're now doing. We'll probably do more with her in the future. Her colleague, Gordon Cormack, is a computer scientist who's done a good deal of research with her on some amazing issues in electronic discovery using some of the data in the TREK studies. They're both pioneers in the field. They've been breaking new ground to continue pushing the field forward, both through the work they've done with TREK and in the articles they've been authoring. More formally, Maura Grossman's counsel at Wachtell, Lipton, Rosen, and Katz. She's co-chair of the eDiscovery Working Group advising the New York State Unified Court System and a member of the Discovery Subcommittee of the Attorney Advisory Group to the Judicial Improvements Committee of the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York. Moore is the coordinator of the legal track of the National Institute of Standards and Technologies Text Retrieval Conference, which is better known as TREC, and an adjunct faculty member at the Rutgers School of Law, Newark, and Pace Law School. She holds a JD from Georgetown University Law Center, an MA and PhD in clinical school psychology from Adelphi University. Gordon Cormack is a professor at the David R. Cheriton School of Computer Sciences and co-director of the Information Retrieval Group at the University of Waterloo. He's a coordinator at the TREK Legal Track and Program Committee, member of TREK at Large. Professor Cormack is the co-author of Information Retrieval, Implementing and Evaluating Search Engines from MIT Press 2010, as well as more than 100 scholarly articles. Professor Cormack holds a BSc, MSc, and PhD in computer science from the University of Manitoba. Glad to have you both on the show here. And I always like to start off first by asking how you got interested in electronic discovery. So, Maura, why don't you start, and then, Gordon, you can tell us how you got interested.
Sure. I've relayed this before since I've been on a couple of your other programs, but briefly, about 2006, 2007, when the new rules came into effect, the revisions to the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure on e-discovery, my mentor suggested this would be an area that he thought I might want to look into. And of course, at the time, I thought that might be a death sentence of having to do document review for the rest of my life. But as I looked into it further and got involved in the Sedona Conference and other activities, I actually found the cross between law and technology to be very, very interesting and challenging. And I jumped in, and I've never looked back.
And how about yourself, Gordon?
Carl, well, as you mentioned, I'm a computer scientist. And as a computer scientist, I like to build computer systems. And I like to be able to show that those computer systems work, and hopefully to show that they work better than any systems that anybody else has ever built. So usually I do this in my ivory tower as a professor and, write papers that are reviewed by other professors. And we have our ways of convincing each other that we're doing good stuff. But we may or may not translate that good stuff into, real, actual, on-the-ground tools that solve problems. Now, I have been involved in TREK, which is the Text Retrieval Conference, both as a participant and a program committee member, since about 1994. TREK is an effort sponsored by the National Institute of Standards and Technology. They're the people that, they have the standard time clocks, and they have all kinds of platinum meters and yards, and, they're part of the Department of Commerce, and they do measurement. And TREK is a research effort that's been ongoing for 20 years now to try to measure how well information retrieval technologies work. And the real impetus for this has been an explosion in the amount of information we have. There's in the last 20 years, our ability to accumulate and store information has grown so much that the game has totally changed. It used to be that the value of the information in your organization was limited by basically your ability to acquire that information. Now you can acquire and store far more information than you can possibly deal with. And really, the value comes from being able to find that information when you need it. So the science of information retrieval is the study of tools and techniques to find the information that you really want. Of course, e-discovery is an example of information retrieval. So is Google search. You know, when you want to find something, you type in a few keywords and go to Google. Anyway, I've been studying information retrieval, and I've been vetting some of the things I've done through Trek. Trek itself has, over the years, become involved in various real application areas for information retrieval. And in 2006, Jason Baron and others started a special track in Trek for e-discovery. And that basically is naturally how I got drawn into it. I said, this is an interesting and challenging real application of information retrieval, and it's an opportunity for me to use a completely different skill set in trying to convince people that what I do works. And so not only doing e-discovery, but evaluating e-discovery is what attracted me. I was first a participant from 2006 through 2009. I was a participant in the Trek Legal Track. And then in 2010, I joined as a coordinator, and that's really where my collaboration with Maura began.
And Maura, why don't you tell me how you got involved with Trek, and then maybe we can talk about what was learned over the first few years of the Trek Legal Track.
Sure. In about 2006, 2007, when I started to get, you know, more deeply involved in e-discovery, and I was learning about all the different search and review tools that were out in the market, I was fascinated by a couple of very cutting-edge vendors that were using fancy, what seemed like artificial intelligence kind of tools, clustering, machine learning, similar processes, and I was absolutely convinced that that was going to be the wave of the future. Of course, most of the people other than Gordon, who I talked to about that, thought I was maybe a little bit bonkers, but be that as it may, at about the same time, I crossed paths with Jason Baron and Connor Crowley at Sedona Conference, and they got me interested in Trek, which I'll talk about in a moment. In 2008, 2009, I was what was called a topic authority, and I interacted with the various teams who were using these different kinds of approaches. And in 2010, when Jason stepped down, I became a coordinator, as did Gordon. And we started this correspondence in which we were trying to understand and bridge the gap between our two worlds, because he spoke in a completely different language than I did. And Jason always talked about marrying the lawyers and the nerds, so we've been collaborating ever since. And as far as Trek, as Gordon said, it's an international interdisciplinary research project sponsored by NIST, which is part of the Department of Commerce, and it's designed to promote research into information retrieval. The first Trek was held in 1992, and the Legal Track itself began in 2006. And in the Legal Track, we're trying to evaluate the effectiveness of search technology specifically in the context of e-discovery. So we use hypothetical complaints that were drafted by various members of the Sedona Conference. And for the first 3 years, we used, from 2006 to 2008, we used documents that were made publicly available from the Master Settlement Agreement of the tobacco litigation. So that was about a 7 million document corpus. In 2009, we switched to the Enron data set, and we've been using that ever since. And these participating teams from all over the world, some are academic, some are vendors, some are law firms, some are combinations of one or more. Some of them are straight academics. And they come together and they try to supply runs using various tools to try to find the responsive documents in a particular data set that we're using. As I said, Enron most recently. So we introduced this interactive task in 2008 and repeated it again in 2009 and 2010, and it really models a document review for responsiveness. It begins with a mock complaint and some requests for production, which we call topics. There's a single topic authority for each topic. The topic authority is a senior attorney, and the participating teams can interact with that topic authority for up to 10 hours. And how can they interact? They can interact by phone. They can interact by email. They can send exemplar documents. They can have conference calls on defining what's responsive, virtually any way they want other than an in-person contact. The reason we ruled out in-person was we did not want to disadvantage academic teams that might not be able to afford that. At the end of this interaction, the team has to submit a binary decision, either it's responsive or unresponsive, for each and every document in the collection for whatever topic they're doing. And then we have a two-step assessment and adjudication process to determine whether the responsiveness determination is correct. If the team and human assessors who we've gotten who are either third-year law students or pro bono services provided by contract attorney firms. So if the team and the assessor agree on whether a document is responsive or not responsive, we assume they're correct. If they disagree, it gets bounced up to the topic authority who will decide which decision was correct. So to give you an example of what a topic might look like, topic 201 from 2009 was all documents or communications that describe, discuss, refer to, report on, or relate to the company's engagement in structured commodity transactions known as prepay transactions. 203 was all documents or communications that describe, discuss, refer to, report on, or relate to whether the company had met or could, would, or might meet its financial forecasts, models, projections, or plans at any time after January 1st, 1999. So you can see they're pretty realistic requests for production. So maybe Gordon can talk a little bit about what we saw over the first couple of years before I actually get involved, and then I can talk a little bit about the interactive test.
Yeah, I mean, the first couple of years, my understanding from reading the reports was you didn't have as much of the machine enabled, but you had some interesting variability year to year with the same documents, and that's a leading question. But you know, if you can talk a little about that and anything else that you identified as being sort of important from the first few years.
That's right. I'll just repeat that it's track is, the legal track has been running now for 6 years, and every year the tasks that are presented to participants are slightly different. They differ so that different things can be measured, and they also differ so that they can better reflect different aspects of the discovery process. In the first couple of years, the task that was given to participants was more or less a traditional search task, what information retrieval people would call ad hoc search. You're given the discovery request, the production request, and then you kind of compose a query or you formulate it and you give it to your system, and then the system does the whole thing and gives you back a set of results. And we found, perhaps not surprisingly, that the discovery task is very much an information retrieval task, but it also differs from traditional information retrieval somewhat. So the traditional search task didn't work all that well. I shouldn't say it didn't work all that well. It probably worked as well as one would expect. Generally speaking, if you sit down and do a search at Google, your objective is to find some documents that meet your information need. Your objective is not to look at every document on the web and categorize it as yes or no. I mean, I know we all occasionally do this. I'm probably not the only person in the world that occasionally sits down at Google and tries to find all documents about me or that refer to me. That's it's an extremely difficult task. But it's a different task from just finding about me. If you want to know about
Gordon, your name's not Carl Shinneman. I guarantee you I can find every document mentioning my name on the web. But anyway, go on.
Anyway, that's a traditional search task. And basically the results were commensurate with what you get for traditional search tasks. And I'll throw a little bit more technical detail at you. Typically, information retrieval effectiveness is measured by recall. Recall is the percentage of all the documents that are out there that you actually found. And precision, which is the percentage of all of the documents that you found that are actually pertinent to what you asked for. These systems were able to get, and Maura will expand on this a little bit more, but the good systems were able to get in the neighborhood of 30% for both of those numbers. There's a trade-off, so you can get 20% in one and 70% in another, but if you try and get the balance of those, you get about 30%. And this is consistent with lots of other studies, including an age-old one by Blair and Marin that was published in Communications of the ACM. So I would say number one is that, you know, the information or search tools give results that are as expected for search tools when applied to the e-discovery task. I guess the other thing that was perhaps surprising, and you alluded to that, is even though no particular search tool did much better than this 30%, if you put them all together, you took all the results found by all the search tools, that they found essentially all of the documents when you put them together. So there's the conundrum. How can you find all or essentially all of the documents and have all the documents that you find actually be relevant and not bring back a whole bunch of garbage. So I think that's what one thing that was learned in those preliminary tasks, but I think it was also learned that the search task by itself doesn't necessarily model what really goes on or what should go on in e-discovery. And I think the word discovery is fairly apt. It's called e-discovery, not e-search. So e-discovery implies to me that what you're doing is you're looking at the data and you're sort of communing with the data and you're discovering what's there. And as you discover what's there, you may modify your behavior. That may control what you search for. And for that reason, a newer interactive task was introduced to the Trek Legal Track starting in 2008. And that's where Maura became involved because she was the topic authority for that task, and she's briefly outlined it. So I'll pass the baton back now.
That's
so in 2008, when Bruce Hedden, who was one of the coordinators at the time, he wanted to make the task more realistic. So he designed this with the other coordinators, the interactive task, which really did more closely model the actual e-discovery process. That would involve having some kind of training or involvement with a lawyer who would be making the final responsiveness determination. And as for what we saw the first couple of years of the interactive task, I was stunned in 2008 by how little most of the teams interacted with the topic authority. Most of them just went off and did their own thing, throwing search terms or whatever it was, and most of them did rather poorly. There was one team that interacted with me quite a bit, and we spent a lot of time defining what was in and what was out, and they actually did quite well. And I guess the lessons learned from those early years, and you can find them, there are two pieces on the Trek website, which we'll talk to you about later, but there are two reflections pieces that reflect on lessons learned by the topic authorities. Is number one was that the teams needed to interact with the TA in order to do well, and the TA needed to interact with the data in order to tell the teams what was responsive and what was not. So it really, we concluded, it really is an interactive and an iterative process, much like what a year or two later people started to call early case assessment. You need both the technology and you need input from a human who has knowledge of the subject matter to figure out what's responsive and what's not, and then to be able to apply that.
Okay. When we presented a program on advanced search technology to a number of prominent federal judges in the Southern District of New York, I remember looking at the Trek data, I think it was the 2009 data, and pointed out that the results of some of the Trek participants surpassed the effectiveness of keyword search as described in the Blair-Marin study. To me, that drove it home completely, but about how effective these tools can be that are more automated. Can you elaborate on this point?
Sure. In Blair and Marin's study, they had asked expert searchers to find relevant documents related to, I believe it was a crash of a train system called the BART. And these expert searchers stopped when they thought they had found 75% of the relevant documents, but it actually turned out that they'd only found 20%. What I think most people don't understand about the Blair and Marin study, and maybe in general, is that there is this trade-off between precision and recall. Most of us focus on the recall, how much did you get, and not so much the precision part, which is how much junk was in there. And Blair and Marin never explored whether the researchers could have found more documents if they were told to continue or if they were willing to accept a lower precision. But that study is kind of held up as the poster child of the disaster of keywords. In Trek 2006, 2007, 2008, again, using purely the ad hoc retrieval methods that Gordon described, just a one-shot deal, not an attempt to improve and iterate, but using a one-shot deal using Boolean keyword searches, the teams on average found 53%, 22%, and 24% of the documents using the single-shot keyword search. But we also found in the interactive task in 08 and 09 and since then that some of the technology-assisted processes were really able to get 75 or 80% precision and recall, and some of them even higher depending on that trade-off. You can get higher in one but lower in the other, and what topics they were doing and so forth. So I remember having a conversation with Gordon in about that time where he would say to me, 70% recall is terrific in the IR world, but for me, that was completely unacceptable. I couldn't go to a legal team at my firm or if we were producing something or to a regulator and say, we've given you 70% of the stuff, be happy. And part of the reason that didn't work is because there's this myth out there that if you throw a bunch of lawyers loose on a large set of documents, they're going to find all of the responsive documents and only the responsive documents, no matter how large this document set is and how many reviewers you have doing it. And even if the legal system could afford to do that, and as you said, Carl, and as Gordon said, the volumes are getting to a point where you can't do that, that myth simply isn't true. So we were comparing essentially technology and holding it to a much higher standard than what humans really do. If you look at what humans do, they they miss documents, they make mistakes, and they're not as efficient and cost-effective as we'd like to believe. So one of the dirty little secrets about document review that we don't talk about much is that if you take any two perfectly reasonable reviewers who are operating in good faith, they're going to disagree about responsiveness an awful lot of the time. And there's this measure called overlap, and that's the measure of consistency between two reviewers, how often they'll code the same documents responsive. And if you take any two human reviewers, they're likely to disagree about responsiveness more than half the time. Then the problem gets even worse if you add more reviewers to the mix, because three reviewers are going to agree on responsiveness maybe 30-some-odd percent of the time. So one of the first people to take a look at this, a classic study of overlap, was Ellen Voorhees using Trek Data in 2000. And what she did was have three expert information retrieval searchers review the same documents for the same topics, and she looked at how she did pairwise comparisons, how often two people agreed or three people agreed on responsiveness. And she found 42% agreement between some, 49% agreement was about the most. So that's about where any two people would agree on any pair of people would agree on a set of documents. And when
let me expand on that for a moment. I just wanted to reinforce. So overlap is the number of times both assessors agree that a document is relevant or responsive divided by the number of times that one or the other thinks it is. So if you have two assessors that both give you a set of 100 documents they think are relevant, it might be that 60 of them are in common and 60 of them are identified by only one of the assessors.
So, you know, I think there's a little hubris in the legal profession, and we thought, well, these are just dumb IR people, you know, who can only agree with themselves about, you know, 50% of the time. We lawyers are much better at it. So in 2010, Reutblatt and his colleagues looked at the level agreement between lawyers. And what they did was they took a second request, a production that had been made to the DOJ, and then they had two human teams separately re-review the documents, and they looked again at the overlap with the original production. And lo and behold, they found about 16%, and at the highest overlap was 28%. So you're getting maybe 20-30% overlap with lawyers in that study. So it's a whole lot of inconsistency. So all of this tells us is that lawyers and non-lawyers are pretty inconsistent and they're unreliable when it comes to making responsiveness determinations. But it tells us nothing about which reviewer is correct or which tool is better or who's better at document review or what kinds of errors the reviewers are making.
Yeah, it's fascinating. The chart that we looked at together, Trek, the amazing thing that amazed me, and this is comparing apples to oranges, but if you looked at the recall rates among the various entrants, they were coming in at, you know, between, you know, 39 to, I think, somewhere around 89 or 90%. It was a much higher, okay. But if you put Blair Maron beneath it with 20%, or the early Trek studies of up to about 30%, these automated approaches, every single entrant surpassed that, every single one. And that, to me, drove home completely that we've got an opportunity to improve here, but a lot of educating to do. So...
I prefer the term, well, and I think Maura as well, technology-assisted review. Automated tends to imply that you just shove the paperwork at a tool and it will do it automatically. And, okay, that's what some of the search technologies purport to do, but I think they're still at that 30% level you're talking about. This is technology assisted in that, you know, there is a human in the loop. That is a human who is a subject matter expert, probably a senior attorney. There may also be lesser attorneys in the loop or operators of the system. And there's also documents involved. So we think of technology-assisted review as this interactive process. And in particular, almost all of the technology-assisted reviews will involve finding some documents, looking at them, having the subject matter expert code them as good or not good, and then feeding those documents back into the system. And there are really, in broad strokes, there are two kinds of technologies that kind of have been brought to bear effectively on this. One is so-called knowledge engineering, where you take these documents and based on these documents, you try to come up with an algorithm or a process that emulates the way a senior attorney might decide whether this document is relevant or not. So, you know, if it contains Cormac and Gordon Cormac and it's not the Scottish bagpiper and it's somebody with computer science and so on, then it maybe is the correct Gordon Cormac. The other approach is a more kind of nuts and bolts approach, statistical machine learning. Essentially, you give these example documents that you have found to the tool, and it looks at them, and it doesn't pretend to understand them. It just learns to distinguish between the ones that you code responsive and not. And to draw a, you know, analogy from criminology, you know, one might be to, you know, try to write code for, you know, a code book or a checklist for that a detective might follow in investigating a case. And the other is, you know, the DNA analysis. You know, you scoop up some blood, run it through a machine, and it says 97% match, so, you know, you go arrest a person or whatever. That's, of course, very oversimplified, and systems may use one or both, or they may use other techniques. They may involve search as well. But the important thing is this is technology-assisted review. This is used to reduce the amount, the number of documents you have to look at by a lot. You know, maybe even you'll typically only look at look at perhaps 1,000 or a few thousand documents, even if you are searching as they were at TREC, either 1 million documents or 7 million document collection. You just look at enough so that you can learn the characteristics of the document. Anyway, that's technology-assisted review, and as Maura said, one team did very well at technology-assisted review in 2008, and then in 2009, there were a number of teams that did very well using both of the techniques that I've generally outlined. Now, these results of 75% recall and precision really raised the eyebrows of the information retrieval crowd because they are, you know, well attuned to expect results of 0.3. And I think I was one of those people. I was fairly suspicious, I would say, of the results in 2008. And that's one of the reasons I got drawn into doing this task in the legal track as a participant. So I was a participant in 2009 and then became a coordinator later in 2010.
And just to try to resuscitate the few lawyers that heard review 1,000, a couple thousand documents and get up to, you know, a higher rate of recall and precision, we're only talking about almost like a first pass review. You still might want to be looking at what you found in more detail. So there is still review work left for lawyers.
But that will presumably be proportional to the number of responsive documents,
yeah.
or at least potentially responsive documents. And certainly in the few matters that I've actually done on live ammunition, the lawyers have wanted to look at the things before they went out the door for privilege review or just for understanding the case. I don't think you change that. But again, if you look at the TREC 2009 study, that was done on 850,000 documents, and I think the largest topic had about 30,000 responsive documents that were identified. So the difference is, you only have to put your expensive help on those 30,000 documents instead of 750. And what's more typical, several of them only had 1,000 or 2 that were responsive.
Right. Yeah. I think that's the key, Carl.
Yep.
Is elevating the responsive documents quickly, and so that the trial team, the litigation team, can look at the documents that are going to make a difference in the case and look at them quicker rather than wading through all the garbage.
Now I want to highlight some of the important work you've done beyond TREC. You both recently published an article, which to me is every bit as important as the front page article in March from the New York Times, throwing out the thought that technology might be a real strong resource to assist with the review. But the reason I really like it is it's a scholarly analysis on machine learning tools. Comparing it to just pure human review. And the article's entitled Technology-Assisted Review and e-Discovery Can Be More Effective and More Efficient Than Exhaustive Manual Review. Not the sexiest title, but if you really look at these words, profound, because no one really was saying that. So what did your study evaluate, and what were your findings? And I was going to ask you, Gordon, but you talked a lot earlier. If you want to still answer this or more, do you want to jump in? I'll let you guys decide.
Gordon can start, and I'll interrupt.
Okay, Morris really already laid the groundwork. And when I first was corresponding with Maura, she actually asked me about a matter. They were evaluating a tool, and I said, "Oh, it looks like this tool, has got 95%. And she said, "Heck, I can't leave 5% behind. It'll kill me." And I said, "Well, what's your alternative? You're going to hire a bunch of contract reviewers? They're going to leave more than 5% behind." And this was a subject of actual controversy between Moore and myself, and that is where this study was born.
Although I don't think it was 95%. I think you gave me a lower number.
Well,
than 95%.
Then I put some statistical confidence
right
on it, and you got even more scared. I can't tell them that there are 2,000 documents left behind. Anyway, what we did was we were having this discussion, and we were thinking about, better mousetraps and everything, but in the end we realized we could never convince anyone to use these tools unless we had a fair fight between manual review and the technology assisted. And of course we couldn't do the manual review because we would be suspect. So what we were able to do was we took the data from TREC that was used to evaluate the systems. The way the evaluation was done was either contract attorneys, actual professional contract attorneys, or teams of law students were used to do a first pass review. And then teams were able to appeal, and the topic authority could override the judgments of the first pass review. And we were able to get all the raw data. And doing that, we were able to work backwards and calculate what the accuracy, what the precision and recall of the first pass reviewers was. And we didn't do this review. It was done for TREC. And it was done with lawyers. And in the case of more than half of the teams were professional review teams. So we thought it would be fun to essentially take the work of the first pass reviewers and evaluate it side by side exactly as if it had been submitted by one of the participating Trek teams. And over to Maura.
And when we did that, lo and behold, even though prior studies by Voorhees and Reutblatt had shown kind of this magic number of recall precision in F1 is a harmonic mean. It's an average of recall and precision weighted slightly toward the one that's lesser. So most of the manual review up to that point had about a 70% precision and recall in F1. And when we looked at the Trek 2009 data, as you said, Carl, it was much higher. It was in the 70s, mid-80s, some even a little bit higher than that. So when we decided, though, those were two different populations, different groups of people, different topics. We needed to look at the same thing, as Gordon said. And lo and behold, the technology, in many instances, the technology-assisted processes beat the manual. We looked at five different topics, like the ones that I described before. Some of them were easier, some of them were harder. And we compared back-to-back a team, a technology-assisted team, with either the group of law students or the professionals. And on recall, the technology-assisted teams, on average, did a little bit better than the law students or professionals, but not statistically significantly so. But on precision and F1, the technology-assisted processes blew it out of the water. They did, you know, highly statistically significantly better than the humans. So, and there was not a single topic where the manual review was significantly outperformed the technology, you know, to a statistically significant degree. So that left us thinking, okay, at worst, it's the same, and at best, it's better, and for much, much, much less labor, because the manual reviewers need to review every single document, but the technology-assisted processes looked at at the lowest number was about 4,300 documents, and at the highest number was 34,500 documents, and if you compare that to close to a million, I think it was 800-something thousand documents, well, the technology is looking at between 0.5% and 5% of the entire collection, which is 50 times less work. So 50 times less work for the same or better outcome seemed to us a no-brainer. That's a game changer. And that's what we showed. But, you know, I think you have to understand that the technology-assisted review finds at least as many responsive documents, meaning recall is at least as good. The technology-assisted review is more accurate. The precision's much better. The technology-assisted review is orders of magnitude more efficient. It's much quicker and cheaper. But not all technology-assisted review and not all exhaustive manual review is created equal. There were differences. Not all of the technology-assisted reviews performed as well. We chose the top two or two of the better performing technologies from Trek 2009 because we thought they'd be more likely to prove our point. But there, you know, there was one manual team that did quite well on one topic. So, you know, it's not a across the board. You know, you can just go out and use any technology you please. Measurement is critical in selecting and defending the tool you've chosen and in discovering what's a better search method and tool.
Yeah, there's still an art present in this for sure. So, well, let's talk about the another article which you both wrote. I mean, it's been a heck of a year for you two in terms of very thought-provoking articles. You presented it at the DESI 4 conference held here in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania,
We've talked a little bit about the conclusion, but it's the inconsistent assessment of responsiveness in e-discovery, difference of opinion, or human error. And, you know, if you want to talk a little bit about what your study evaluated and what were your conclusions.
Sure. I'll lay the groundwork, and then Gordon can describe some of the findings. So when we were doing our first study, we were very curious about why the humans did less well. And there was a lot of hand-wringing and arguing at Trek 2010 when we met in November about what this was due to. And some people felt, well, it's because there's so many fuzzy documents, arguable documents, that it's hard to tell whether they're responsive or not responsive, so we should just all throw up our hands and go home and not even try to measure this. And, you know, some others felt, no, you know, humans make errors, and it isn't fuzziness. So Gordon and I decided to look, as part of our first study, at whether, in fact, humans were making like flat-out errors or really there was fuzziness, because there was this perception that everybody disagrees on responsiveness and therefore, you know, it's ill-defined and we can't measure it. So we wanted to look at whether the documents were really fuzzy or whether they were clear-cut. So for topic 204, which is the topic I was the topic authority for in 2009, that was a request that asked for basically documents that had to do with shredding or other activities involving the alteration, destruction, retention, and lack of retention of documents. And, for example, one document where the computer got it, or the technology-assisted review got it, and the professional reviewer got it wrong, was a document that said, I'll be shredding till 11 a.m., so I should have plenty of time to make it. Stunned us. Another example where the computer-assisted or technology-assisted got it and the human didn't is more ambiguous. It's one of these mailbox warnings where it was, you know, saying your mailbox is approaching its limits, you ought to delete. And I think we could argue whether that's really related to shredding. I mean, I was the topic authority, and I ultimately decided that somebody who got a message like this was likely to delete documents to make more room, and therefore, being conservative, that we should include these. But somebody could argue just as well that it technically wasn't responsive. So basically what we were trying to look at is, are the mistakes more of the first kind, these flat out, it says shredding right on its face, or are they more of this second kind where reasonable people can disagree? And in our first study that we talked about, when we just looked at a couple of topics, two topics, and we went back and classified what the errors look like, Gordon and I found that the vast majority, 65% or so, were these flat-out, inarguable boo-boos, just straight errors where anybody looking at it should have caught it and should have called it responsive, and that there were relatively few of the fuzzy documents. So we still didn't believe that this was accurate. We thought this just can't be. So that's when we went and did the second study. So why don't you talk about that, Gordon?
Okay. So the follow-up study was really just an expanded version of what we had done as a kind of an afterthought in our first paper. And for that one, we looked at all of the cases where the assessor had been, or where the first pass reviewer had been overturned in either direction. Either they said it was responsive and then they were corrected to be non-responsive, or the other way around. And we did that for all the topics, which happened to be seven topics. And we looked at it. We looked carefully at the coding guidelines and at the topic and at the document. And we decided that for 90% of the documents, not only was the assessor wrong, but it was very clear-cut, that we did not believe a reasonable person duly considering all the evidence would think there was any real controversy about the document. Now, there were a few, and this is only 10% of the mistakes that were made, or the codings that were marked as mistakes. We did find some that we thought were arguable, you know, of the kind Morris says, or other ones where we could imagine a reasonable people might disagree on this. And then there were a couple where we thought the topic authority was just flat wrong. And it happens that we had the topic authority for one of those topics, namely Mora. So I had labeled, I did this topic, and I labeled 10 documents as that Mora had, for which Mora had overridden the first past assessor. I labeled 10 of them as either, no, I think the TA was wrong, or I think this was too close to call. And we had Mora look at those. Why don't you tell me what happened, Mora?
Well, I went back and looked at the 10 documents blind. Of course, it was a couple of years later, and I didn't remember them. I was doing them fresh. And this time, instead of saying, responsive or unresponsive, I think we allowed me also to move them into to say whether it was clearly responsive or unresponsive, or whether it was arguable. And I don't have the data in front of me, but I know that I think that half the time I was consistent with my original adjudication and ruled the same thing. And then there were several for which I reversed myself. And then there were also several where I moved a document that I had coded as clearly responsive or unresponsive into the arguable category. Gord, do you have the numbers in front of you?
No, that's correct. You reversed yourself three times, and you labeled your previous decision as debatable two times. But the funny thing is there was not a single case where I said it was clearly in one direction, and you said it was clearly in the other. So the only cases where you reversed yourself, I had said it was debatable. And the only cases where you had said it was debatable, those were ones where either I had said it was debatable or I had disagreed with you. But this is just a tiny fraction of the document. So the main conclusion here is that when assessors disagree, at least in the experience we have so far, I think we can conclude fairly well that when two assessors disagree, it's because one of them is wrong. And you can get a third opinion, or you can very carefully analyze and find out who's wrong. And in that kind of that challenges the popular belief that responsiveness is just a matter of taste. And if two assessors disagree, we shouldn't strive for good recall because it's just a matter of taste which particular documents go in the basket anyway. Clearly, the coding guidelines by the topic authority matter. Those resolve ambiguities like the one Mora said. You know, if an automated delete your email message is responsive, that can be written in a coding guideline, and then whether it be manual coders or technology-assisted review, that augments and clarifies the discovery request. But once you have a set of coding guidelines, we found that there were very, very few, that the vast majority of disagreements were, in fact, attributable to incorrect coding. A small postscript for this is, this is completely consistent with information retrieval research, I believe. You know, assessors make errors. They're looking through a lot of documents. They overlook stuff. They have brain fade. They hit the wrong key.
I was profoundly impacted by that study. I've actually hired a software person to try to build a test review right to try to pre-screen. But I was really amazed by the article, and both these articles were in the field, I think, really important, and I hope more people go out and take the time to read them, which is why I wanted to,
personally focus in on the work you both have done in this area.
Carl, how accurate are your subjects in your pre-screening test?
How accurate? What is definitely true here is that people will disagree. But what I did was I started with basically a model that did machine categorization with a tool that I have seen has had very good results. And from there, I had a human look at it and decide if they agreed. And then I've been giving the test out, but I'm trying to establish a bench line with some people that I consider to be professional reviewers. This is a work in progress, by the way, okay? We're still trying to get the technology not to be as buggy, et cetera. But I think what you raise and what the article raises is, and what Moore is looking at 10 raises, is that people are going to disagree over time looking at the same documents. There is a form of art to this, but if you can find really bad, consistent bad results, it can be a screening method to prevent putting an army of some mediocre and some good on a project. But I look at it no different than I do from an interview. You can give a bad interview. It's just another way to get a feel of a candidate. And it's a missing piece that people aren't doing today. But I'd love to talk to you offline and show it to you and get your reaction, because it's a hard thing to design for sure. But this effort was based on your article, so I can tell you it had an impact on me personally and possibly professionally. Let's wrap this up by revisiting Trek here. What exciting things do you see for Trek coming up in 2011, and how can people get involved?
Sure. Well, rather than running the interactive task a third time, this year we decided to focus on the machine learning tools, the tools that some people refer to as predictive coding, things like that. And what we're particularly interested in looking at this year is in measuring the interactive process more carefully. How much more work involving the human or the topic authority yields how much better result. So this year we're going to have the topic authorities review up to 1,000 documents requested by the particular team. They can choose which documents. They will show it to the topic authority. They'll get a thumbs up, thumbs down, responsive, unresponsive determination, and they can use those documents as a seed set or as an exemplars to find all of the responsive documents in the collection. And what we'll be measuring is how well can you do with no adjudications, no decisions from a human? How well can you do with 100? How well can you do with 300, with 1,000? And a mop-up task, which will be all of the documents that any team has requested. How well can any team do with that? So what we're going to be looking at is the improvement in performance along with the increase in human input, and that human input will be measured in terms of how many documents. Another thing that we're going to be looking at is, given all this human inconsistency, how best to evaluate what the truth is or what the correct answer is. Is it the authoritative TA who adjudicates? Maybe we should take the majority vote from multiple assessors. But how can we measure this better? And if people want to get involved, they can email Gordon or me. Our Trek website was recently updated. If you Google Trek Legal Track, you can find it easily, or you can go to http://trek.umics.umd.edu/. But easier to find with Googling Trek Legal Track. We're looking for people to help with assessment of the documents. We need human reviewers. People can become, for next year, topic authorities have other roles to help. But if you're interested, get involved, and encourage your vendors to get involved, because the only way we're going to improve these tools is by measuring them, making sure they're defensible. And the only way we can do that is if the vendors participate.
Right. Well, look, I'd like to thank both of you, Moore and Gordon, for joining us at ESI Bytes. It's always a pleasure to have you share your knowledge with us and our listeners, and hopefully we'll be able to do more shows with you later this year. And to the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com with a Y for a complete list of our show. You can remember our show and website phonetically, as it sounds out, as Easy Bytes of ESI information. So however you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. I'd like to thank our sponsor, Jurnov, for their continued support of ESI Bytes. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess, wishing you a nice day.